Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, April 23rd, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Hello and welcome to the podcast this week. Good to see you guys. It's good to have this once a week check-in. Kishore Hari, how you doing?
I did the conference call thing of being on mute by accident and started talking. Like, you would feel like 6-8 weeks into this, I would be past that, but nope.
I thought you
also,
had...
hi.
Yes, hi. Weren't you saying that you default to being on mute and you push to talk?
Yeah, I push to talk normally, but I screwed that up.
You're so old school, like walkie-talkie style. Breaker 1-2.
It's a video. It's just a video game etiquette thing.
That's true. I appreciate
that. That would be a neat thing if you could hack it together to have an old school, you know, plastic shell of a walkie-talkie, and it doesn't actually have. Maybe you could put the microphone in it, right? Kind of wire a lav in there. But make it so it is push to talk, but you're doing your Ventrilo, your Discord or Zoom. Yeah. And
I had another idea. Actually, my wife is doing yoga and Pilates, and she is realizing that she doesn't have the feedback of being with a group or even an instructor so much anymore, although she does video conference with her instructor from time to time. And I said, well, what if I hooked up a device so that when you start your Pilates, you hit a button and that tweets, and then everybody who likes the tweet, it like activates a mechanical clapping device or flashes a light or has the sound of applause or says something like, good job, keep it up.
That's a very Simone Yetch type invention, right?
Yeah, I thought so.
She did a build recently that was very much that, the kind of mechanical positive feedback, because we're not getting much of that these days, certainly not from our family members at home, right? Your kids
don't get any
positive feedback.
When that video came out of the pat on the shoulder, I was like, I kind of want to go over there and get a pat on the shoulder right now.
I just want to feel something. That's why we're doing this, because I just want to feel something every week. That's not a screaming child. Anyway, Jeremy, how you doing?
Hi, I'm well. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you too. We are going to have a relatively shorter episode today. We're started a little bit late and we have a little bit of time constraints. But let's get right into it then with our, as I delay this, here it goes.
Top story this week.
So it is a little bit bummer of a top story, but it's not COVID related. So this is, well, it's kind of just marketplace and economy related maybe, but it was announced today that Magic Leap, the augmented reality company, isn't going away, but they are they're kind of shifting their focus and restructuring, which is just a euphemism for also a layoff. So it's been reported by Bloomberg that about 1,000 people from Magic Leap have been laid off as the company is shifting from making a consumer-facing headset, the Magic Leap 2, sequel to the Magic Leap 1, though you can still buy today, to something that's enterprise only. Is this a big surprise?
I mean, weren't they being shopped around before the pandemic broke? Like, they were looking to sell. I think the price tag I remember was like $5 to $10 billion. So it felt like this move has been in the works. And I wonder if just because of the economic fallout of what's happened, they just couldn't get access to capital, which may have accelerated this choice. This seemed to be like the trajectory they were unfortunately on over the last like 3 to 6 months.
It's funny, when I think of Magic Leap, I don't think of lack of access to capital. You know, they had a good run, and in some respects they really are still the best game in town for AR, and I think that they had some neat tech. I just never saw the practical applications from a consumer standpoint. So I think that the pivot to enterprise is overdue.
And I think maybe they were a victim of their own hype, right? Like, and the maybe the inability, and maybe it was impossible to meet the expectation of that hype. You know, you said the very first thing you think about when we think of Magic Leap is all the funding that they had reported, yeah, and their valuation with all their investors. You know, we've all read the Kevin Kelly Wired story about how excited people were with their early technology demos and how eager people were, you know.
If Shaquille O'Neal's into it, it's going to be good.
Well, he was also adopting tigers from the Tiger King. So let's not trust Shaq for investing advice. But yeah, that's exactly it, right? The idea that this was while modern VR headsets were on the up and up, they were one of the few companies that were not doing VR, but going straight to AR with, you know, investment. And we assume that the money that was being put in was equal to not just their ambition, but also their ability to deliver. And they did deliver a headset, right? They shipped the Magic Leap 1. We've used it. It's been over a year and a half since that's come out. So it's been quite a while. And looking at how big, you know, they had the whole Magic Leap conference, they've had presences, they had, you know, at so many conventions, GDC, you know, Comic-Con. They definitely, I think, released that product with the idea that, with the expectation certainly, that way more people would be adopting it than ended up buying this $2,300 headset. Yeah. And that disconnect is kind of mind-blowing to me, because using it, you and I using it, like, even if that headset offered the optics that we had hoped for in terms of a field of view, in terms of having a multi-plane focus, solving the convergence accommodation conflict, the form factor and the ecosystem was not ripe for the market. Like, people in the real world, mainstream audiences were not ready for this type of device, and still won't be anytime soon.
And people would argue that they're not even ready for virtual reality yet, because yeah, that hasn't taken off, you know, to the level of the Nintendo Switch or mainstream consoles. Despite the fact that there's a couple experiences on Magic Leap that are unparalleled, you know, in virtual reality, like the Dr. Grodbrort's multiplayer shooter.
Yep.
I've never done anything like that, like ever, like in any other medium. And I think that that's truly next level stuff. It's just too expensive, too unfriendly. There's too many, you know, technical restrictions. But that is a taste of the future that I think we will eventually have at the consumer level once prices and, you know, features are in line.
And enterprise seems to be a great place for that, because just as VR, you know, is finally hitting its stride in the enthusiast market and in the consumer space, because we know, I know certainly family members and friends are interested, and many have picked up, you know, the Oculus Quest because of the price point, and they look at that as something equivalent to maybe that or PS4, and it's a mid console. You know, they're looking for a way to spend $400 to have a unique experience. But VR really, before COVID, was thriving and had interesting explorations in location-based experiences, and AR seemed to be really ripe for that too. Like a multiplayer Dr. Gorbor experience would be really cool in a void laser tag style arena.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about those high-end experiences. I was even impressed with like their room mapping and just the ability to, you know, map different geometries in the space and remember that and map walls. And so the only, like, I feel for the employees that were laid off, and I understand the necessity for the pivot. The thing I was actually hoping for is a company like Apple coming in and buying the tech, because that what that might signal for the future of AR and the integration of this technology in some future plans. Maybe that's still on the horizon, but that's where I really want to see them go. I get the enterprise play and how that can makes us midterm. But if we really want to see consumer AR down the line, I still think some sort of acquisition for the underlying technology makes sense.
But that underlying technology, that SLAM, where it's doing the world mapping, That's not valuable to Apple because they already have that. Like if you look at the LiDAR based system in the new iPad, it's really, really good. It's like, I don't know who's using it and what they're using it for, but if you apply that to augmented reality, it's a natural symbiosis.
But what about like the glasses, like that tech end of the technology and the hardware, like that's something that Apple could use. Maybe.
But Magic Leap didn't have anything special in that and in what they released, right? Unless the Magic Leap 2, unless they were holding back, and the assumption is the kind of the lenses they wanted to make, the light field lenses, were not ready for Magic Leap 1. That's why they used the waveguide system. And if Magic Leap 2 doesn't have something that truly, you know, either protected by patents and truly like the fruit of a decade worth of research and that's ahead of the competition, there's no reason or way that someone like a Facebook or an Apple would want to acquire them except, you know, down the line just for patents and gutting a company, because the valuation isn't in the tech. The valuation was to be first to market and was to have not only the technology but also the market share, the mind share, because of all the hype, and they've lost that, right? Magic Leap, like who knows what they're you know where they are in terms of pushing for the patents that they do have, but that $10 billion they sought after, I mean that opportunity is long past. Otherwise they would have been picked up, and Apple has the money to do their own R&D and is doing their own R&D, and has a whole other business, you know, many other businesses that do make billions of dollars that can support that. And the same goes for Facebook, you know, and they have not only the ad business that they have to fund, you know, the Facebook company, first of all, to fund, you know, Oculus and the mixed reality departments, but also the VR division to generate content that will presumably also work in AR.
I realize when I say, right after I say that VR has not reached any kind of like market penetration that is, you know, considerable or whatever, that you can't buy headsets right now because they're out of stock. Like no, people didn't make enough for the pandemic because apparently now everybody wants to buy them. And now whenever a Quest or something comes in stock, it's an instant thread on Reddit.
Yeah.
And I would imagine the supply chain for these things is it's going to take a while for them to catch up. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're out of stock for a while, for months, which is unfortunate. But
there's a discussion also to be had. Like now is the time to see VR surge, right? The unfortunate time we're in, where everyone is stuck in at home, VR has an opportunity to connect people in an interesting way. In a way that, you know, this video conferencing technology is doing right now, but it maybe just didn't align right? VR maybe still needed 2 years of ecosystem development, right? Like if, whether it's Horizons on the Facebook side or the headsets being just a little bit more comfortable, just a little bit more ergonomic and usable, but AR definitely was misaligned with the timing now, right? If Facebook or Apple had come out with glasses a couple of years ago and we were on second generation glasses today and we then had to go for months of shelter in place, that would have been a potential huge opportunity for VR and AR. But you know, it's just bad timing. So, you know, again, good luck to all the people still there. The company still exists. They're making deals with medical industries. We're obviously thinking of our friends over at What a Workshop, What a Game Shop, who had been working on the Magic Leap games, and we haven't heard anything from them yet, but if we do, we'll be sure to share it. All right, that's all I think we have to say about Magic Leap, so let's move on. Well, they finally did it. San Diego Comic-Con finally announced that it's not happening. I think this is not a big surprise to people following what's been going on around the world, but it was originally slated for late July, and the San Diego Convention Center right now is obviously being used to support housing for the pandemic, but it's not going to happen, and it's not being rescheduled either. So Comic-Con 2020 just won't happen. The first time in 51 years that there won't be a Comic-Con, but hopefully, and fingers crossed, that next year we'll be able to come back, and the organization, Comic-Con International, will be able to regroup and make an event happen.
I think you just hit puberty, Norm. Your voice.
Yeah, I appreciate Deep Voice Norm showed up for the kind of somber chat about SDCC. I think San Diego is going to be fine as a con because it's supported by the entertainment industry, and so I think there's always going to be dollars flowing into that event. Maybe it'll look different. Maybe it'll be more muted next year as we're still kind of figuring this out. I wonder if this is like the canary around other cons that aren't on such like financial footing. I expect Dragon Con in Atlanta to be canceled this year. I expect, you know, Emerald City was already postponed / canceled. I think we're going to see a lot of cons kind of go through this phase where they're just going to have to cancel their events for 2020, and probably a lot of them won't come back. And that is like a level of sadness that I'm not quite ready to deal with, but it's something we have to start thinking about, because I don't think socially we'll be ready to go back to large scale events for a while.
I mean, it's a reality check, right? Because we knew the near conventions, the ones that were in the spring, that it made so much sense, like South by Southwest, you know, absolutely made sense at that time.
Absolutely had to. Yeah.
But Comic-Con holding out kind of gave this hope for at least the pop culture following media and public that things would be returning to a little bit like normal by late July. And obviously we'll talk about this in a moment of science of what the next year could look like. But you know, New York Comic-Con in the fall is another holdout right now. And while we have companies like Facebook and Oculus saying that they won't hold any in-person events larger than 50 people for the next year, an expectation is that New York Comic-Con probably won't happen, especially given that New York's a hotspot. But you know, the fact that they have it closed, it's just is more the reality of them figuring out the business side of it than the practical assumption that it's going to not happen.
Right. I was talking to a friend that goes to a lot of cons, and he said, you know, we always make that joke about getting con crud. So think about that in the context of what's happening now, and like, how long is it going to take for you to, you know, be okay making that joke again? Like, am I going to get sick after this con? It's probably going to be a little while. So I imagine there won't really be much of any sort of con this year, and that makes me so sad on so many levels.
So let's project just for a minute into the future, a year or two, three. We have a vaccine for COVID, and it has been distributed, and people have received it. Do you foresee something like Comic-Con going back to normal at that point, or have we sort of learned a lesson, and we have a new level of precautions we're going to be taking as a society?
So I want to say, I don't know what day it is. So like projecting forward a year is quite a leap. And there's so many assumptions, and like what you said, like that we can make a vaccine, that it can be distributed and manufactured. It's going to take a long time. And then there's the economic impact, which we don't know what that's going to look like for us either, which deeply affects these cons. Like, are people going to have money to spend to even go to these things? I don't think it's like a switch, though, or at least I'm preparing mentally that it's not a switch, that, you know, let's say all the things you say happen. Will we just flip a switch and San Diego Comic-Con is going to feel like it did in 2019, in 2021? Probably not. It'll probably be more muted. It'll probably have some remnant social impacts in what it looks like. Now, 2022, 2023, like as we project forward, is it going to start to revert back to where it was? I hope so. But I think projecting out more than a week or two at this point is a fool's errand at best. So I remain hopeful because those cons mean a lot to me personally. And I think they mean a lot culturally to the communities, especially that Tested interacts with. So I hope so, but I'm also just preparing myself that there is no such thing as normal anymore, that we're going to have to find that together. And probably some cons are going to change because of that.
Well, one thing I want to talk about is what takes place of those kind of gatherings in the near time frame, right? And there are conventions that are looking at ways to be digital conferences, right? And
I went to one. I went to a virtual con and I just watched a panel that way. It was okay.
And I think what's maybe a practical thing is that, like, a lot of innovations happening and people are experimenting with ways to gather virtually and what that means from an interaction standpoint. Like, the things you get from going to a convention, and a convention and conference are sometimes muddled, right? If you're talking about a corporate or industry event, right, you have one-to-many interactions where there's an announcement. You know, when OnePlus did their OnePlus 8 announcement, they had a stage and they had a speaker and they filmed it professionally, but it was just like a live stream, as if you watched, you know, an Apple keynote or a Samsung keynote. And you're going to have, I think, some of those for these type of pop culture events. And like, we've seen live streams kind of at E3. But what does it mean for the conference or the convention part of it, where people need and want to meet, right? One of the reasons we love going to conventions is it's basically a location-based experience, right? Cons are LBEs. And just like LBEs and theme parks are trying to survive and trying to find ways to adapt, right? Conventions are going to have to find ways to adapt. So how do you get the feeling? How do you get that feeling of going to a vendor hall or seeing your friends at a small panel or seeing cosplayers or seeing some type of thing that you would normally get and pay $50 for at a convention and get some of that virtually? And I think you can look to events like BlizzCon, right? BlizzCon is a massive sold out, you know, when it was happening, a massive sold out in-person event, but they also sold out the huge amount of virtual tickets, and they had the kind of infrastructure to make it also feel exclusive. When you bought a virtual ticket, you got a virtual pass to a panel room. You got to watch certain live streams. They had all this technology around it. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot of conferences going that way this year. And then even going forward, you know, it won't be the switch to turn on 100,000 people going to Comic-Con, but maybe Comic-Con becomes a little smaller, and the fire marshals restrict number of people in the halls, but for vendors and exhibitors and media studios who want to get access to the wide market, they can tap into the innovations that have happened, you know, in 2020, to then have virtual, to be a melding of a virtual convention and a in-person convention.
I think you're right. I think, like, the Hall H panels are going to go virtual in some capacity. I think the things that are hard to replace are the cosplay, and the maker halls, especially the sense of discovery of finding and seeing new things. One of the cosplay groups I'm in, we had a Zoom chat a week ago, just to kind of, like, converse, like, how are we doing all this stuff? Because there's a couple cosplayers in that group that, like, they're used to, like, every other weekend being at a con, and what does that look like? And I think that community, what innovation looks like in that community, we can't even fathom yet. But I'm already starting to see a lot more like tutorials, like workshop style cosplay events go virtual, which, you know, maybe that is a sign of things to come.
And maybe it's more of a festival atmosphere, right, than a conference atmosphere.
I think some of these things, like workshops and panels, actually lend themselves to an online experience. But you're right about the cosplay, and that's something that you can't get on Zoom. I mean, just the tactile sense of the materials and seeing the whole picture in three dimensions and spinning around. But it does kind of remind me, and this is a completely different angle, it does remind me of Ready Player One and how that could potentially transform into virtual reality if people start digging on and making virtual items for their avatars and their existences in some sort of VR place, and then you really could wander around and interact with people and see things in three dimensions and get a better sense of that. But that is a completely different experience than the current one.
And a lot of reasons that people went to conventions were for the selfie factor, right? People go out to places to document and to feel like not only there, but also to get that picture of themselves there. And how do you replicate that in a virtual environment? And how do you replicate the kind of exclusivity of feeling like you saw, this is the thing that you got to see and had the shared experience with, you know, 1,000 people or 10,000 people, and feel like it's a communal experience. Is it a time thing? Is it more democratized so way more people can join and maybe way more people can exhibit? And what the organizers are doing is just making sure that you know, things are happening and there's access to it on a certain weekend or a certain week. And that's why I think it's going to feel more like a festival atmosphere rather than a convention atmosphere. Anyway, moving on in terms of digital streaming services, we've talked last week and past 2 weeks about Quibi launching, and we haven't heard anything about it this week, so things may not be looking so great. But a new contender has appeared. HBO Max has its launch date. It is going to be May 27th, and well, it has a few things going for it, right? One, they've licensed a bunch of exclusives, so all of South Park. They have Friends, which is a big streaming thing, back catalog thing. They have all the existing HBO catalog. And it's going to be, the biggest thing for it is that it's basically a superset of HBO, and anyone who's already paying for HBO gets it.
Oh. So it
comes in with an existing user base. And this is the big confusing part.
So if I have HBO Go, and I think I have Go, right? Because I don't have a cable subscription. Then I...
No, you have Now.
Okay, thank you. Then I have Now. So if I have Now, then I get this?
You get this.
Oh,
yes. Okay. This is the way... And we've been super confused about this in the past. I think we've talked about this. Like, why does AT&T, Time Warner, who owns HBO, why did they launch this if it's going to be the same price, $15 a month, and it's going to give you... everything in HBO that you already get, but more. Like, what is the catch here, right? And I think the catch is that they want to play at the level of Netflix and Amazon Prime and HBO, as much as it costs, wasn't reaching as many people as they wanted to. Because HBO is seen as, you know, more mature, adults only, more edgy, and people bought it as an add-on, but didn't feel like it was a necessity. They want HBO Max to feel like it's a necessity.
Okay.
And the fear is that the money they would normally spend to make the great HBO programming that we enjoy would be then diluted, or the quality would be diluted, and that's still yet to be seen. They have announced, for example, Westworld, one of their prestige series, is getting a season 4, which I'm very excited about because I'm deep into season 3 right now. If you haven't been watching, the last episode was fire, was amazing. They also announced that J.J. Abrams has signed with them and are developing 3 shows for HBO Max. One is a series based on The Shining. One is, it's...
Shining remake or like a prequel, sequel kind of thing?
I think it's going to be an offshoot. So whatever that means, prequel,
ooh,
sequel.
Other hotels are haunted. Okay, cool.
I don't know if it's going to be about the hotel. It's, you know, it is. It, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's going to be about the hotel and other things that happen in the hotel, essentially. So whereas Dr. Sleep, which was the sequel, I don't know if either of you saw that. Dr. Sleep was the one that was a follow-up to Danny Torrance, What Happens When He Grows Up, played by Ewan McGregor. And it was kind of this bridging of the book, Dr. Sleep, as well as a sequel to the Stanley Kubrick Shining. And that was this kind of juggling act because the Stanley Kubrick Shining was not something that Stephen King liked at all. It was very different, as you follower of Ready Player One would know. But this seems like not about the Torrance family and just about the hotel as a place. So Duster is the other show he's doing. Don't know much about
it's about that. Jackets.
It's set in the 1970s Southwest, life of a getaway driver and a growing crime syndicate. So a crime story in the 1970s.
Okay, cool.
Get behind that. And the third one is Justice League Dark.
What? Justice League Dark?
League Dark.
Is this good news?
Yeah, maybe. Like, Justice League Dark is this kind of offshoot of the Justice League of, like, you know, you Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, except Justice League Dark has more magical enabled superheroes. So, like, Zatanna and Constantine and, like, the
Swamp Thing.
So they get into, like, the occult a little bit. So this, like, in terms of like a J.J. Abrams story, like, you can go into weird places with those characters. And I'm one of those like weird Constantine stands. I think he was like an amazing character, and you can do really amazing stuff with him. So yeah, I'm like mildly excited, but like hesitant.
All right.
Because that's a weird choice.
And two of the characters, two of the roster have their own shows. Like Constantine has been a WB show. Swamp Thing was on that DC Universe show. That's not continuing. So this is going to be a whole new take on it. Zatanna is probably the most well-known of the characters and intersects the most with the main Justice League. Calling it Justice League is a complete misnomer. It's nothing like the Justice League we know from mainstream comics, and you know from like Batman, Superman. It's more Vertigo comics, so these are definitely the more mature stories. And when you know DC and Vertigo basically allowed their characters to intermingle, this is a way to have a team of those characters come together, and like Shore said, to take on the occult and the really kind of dark mysteries. So more universal horror, I think, than you know capes and spandex, even though there's spandex in there. And Guillermo del Toro had been trying to make a Justice League Dark movie for a long time. So the one sad part about this is we may never get to see Guillermo del Toro's vision of this if J.J. Abrams is producing his own take on it. But it could be good.
No reason he couldn't direct.
I mean,
just saying.
Yeah. But I don't see it happening.
Okay.
Right? I'll never say never. Moving on to other movie news. Hey, Jeremy, you're very excited about this Spike Jonze documentary coming out?
I hope we all are. This sounds fantastic. So I desperately wanted to see this live show, this Beastie Boys story that toured the country. And I was too late to the game, so I didn't get tickets, sold out everywhere. But it's the two remaining Beastie Boys, Mike D and Ad Rock, toured around and told the story of you know, the genesis and the, you know, the life of the Beastie Boys until the loss of MCA several years ago. And it's a phenomenal story. I mean, if you know anything about the Beastie Boys, like there's nothing like them in music, you know, to this day. And it's been turned into a movie by their famed director of Sabotage and several other videos, Spike Jonze. And it's coming out on Apple TV Plus this weekend. So it's time for me to activate my free trial.
If you can, right? Wasn't there a time limit on that?
7-day free trial for anybody.
Oh, okay. Not the year long. Okay, because you didn't get the new phone.
Thank you for pointing that out. That's right.
So this was originally supposed to premiere at South by Southwest, and right. Apple TV picked it up. And that's great for anyone who has a service. And of course, you know, they need the content. But leads into, you know, what happened to a lot of those movies at South by Southwest. There were reports that, you know, Amazon Prime was going to go do a virtual South by Southwest Film Festival, and they are going to do one, and it is going to also be this weekend, April 27th. But it turns out that of the 135 films that were going to be at South by Southwest, and they were all invited to be part of this, only four narrative features are taking part of this. A few documentaries and a lot of shorts, but only 5% of the films that were submitted and were going to show at South by Southwest are taking part at this film festival, this virtual Amazon Prime film festival. And that makes it, I get it. It's all about like the money, right? Like a filmmaker and crew spends years of their time making a film. They show it at a film festival with the opportunity to get, you know, some buzz about it and to have a distributor like pick it up and put it on the big screen and fulfill the destiny of the film. All filmmakers want to see, you know, not only have an audience appreciate their film, but see it on the big screen. To just put it on Amazon Prime, it fulfills part of it. You're going to have people see it, but you're going to miss out on this opportunity to recoup your investment. And maybe Amazon, who knows what the finances were, didn't want to fork up, you know, the money that maybe Apple did for the Beastie Boys documentary for all of the film. So right now, it's actually a lot of foreign films that are taking part of this. So Hollywood Reporter has a list of the narrative features. There's this Bulgarian film, Guatemalan film, French film, two French films, a bunch of U.S. documentaries. But for the short films, which typically don't get distribution anyway, that's where people who missed out on South by Southwest not happening this year will get a little bit of taste of that, because a lot of the documentary shorts and narrative shorts are being streamed. So I'll be checking those out. Moving on, I'll talk about two movie delays. Batman has been delayed. Warner Brothers has announced that Batman and Shazam both have new release dates. So Batman, which is originally supposed to be in June of next year, is instead going to be pushed a few months just to October of next year. And what some people pointed out is that this will be the first time that a Batman movie will be in theaters during Halloween, which could be cool. And then The Flash is going to be pushed to June 2022. And Shazam 2 is going to be later that year, November 2022. So
now, if they don't call Shazam 2 Electric Boogaloo, I don't even know the point of...
That's more of a Deadpool territory, isn't it?
I mean, Shazam has electrical powers, though, so...
That's a good point. Yeah.
2022, the year of lightning for DC. Lightning will strike again. Shazam 2. There you go. The original release date for Batman 2021, June, has now been claimed by Sony for the Venom sequel, which is pushed out of this year. This is the one that Andy Serkis is directing, and we do get a title for it. The title is going to be Venom, Let There Be Carnage. So a big hint.
If you're going to do be fighting Carnage in the title, just do Maximum Carnage and be done with it.
That's a really great point. I don't know why. I mean, Let There Be Carnage. Maximum. It's an inferior title than Maximum Carnage, for all the reasons.
You know what?
Go ahead. No. Tom Hardy posted a picture about this, and in his picture, he had a picture of Venom pulling apart Spider-Man. And so the other hope is that they're gonna collapse their Sony superhero universe and have a Spider-Man crossover in that movie.
Pulling apart Spider-Man, that's horrible.
I mean, it's horrible. That's what Venom does.
I want to know the story of Andy Serkis. Like, I want to see his documentary, because what a weird story that the guy goes from motion capture, like, guy, like, you know, he's wearing ping pong balls and becomes famous for being Gollum, to being like an actor in Black Panther. He was like awesome, and now he's like a director. I bet he's gonna be good at that too. As like, how many super talented people out there are unknown because they didn't find, you know, an open door to get into motion capture? It's crazy.
I mean, and that's the whole thing. Like, he's been pushing for not just motion. I mean, let's get our terms right. Also,
performance capture.
And I've been corrected on this multiple times. Motion capture is physical body movements. Performance capture is when you put the camera and the dots in your face. And I think true for Gollum, it was motion capture. And then that's evolved for all the Planet of the Apes movies and all the other films he's done, including Snoke and performance capture. And for performance capture, that's where he wants those performers and actors to be recognized for their acting ability. And being in the world, like, he has a whole company dedicated to performance capture and has a volume where people can do mocap and performance cap. And he, you know, speaking of Magic Leap, you know, he did a whole Magic Leap collaboration where he had like this play essentially that you could watch in augmented reality. And that's a place where AR really could benefit, having, you know, what looks like a projected one-to-one person that's virtual, and you need to have that animated. And it's very expensive to animate that by hand the way that Pixar would. But yeah, good for him. And this is, I think, his second film. He did that Jungle Book adaptation that's on Netflix. It wasn't super well received, but I'm really curious to what he brings to Venom. Speaking of Pixar artists, while in quarantine on their YouTube channel, are doing something fun. They are having their artists do little tutorials as to how to draw some of their characters. They've done two of these so far. It's not Woody, it's not Buzz, but Duke Kaboom. If you like Toy Story 4, if you want to learn how to draw Duke Kaboom, you can watch a Pixar animator to show you how to actually draw him, as well as Barley Lightfoot from Onward.
It's not the only two. Those are the only two in the article. You can also learn how to draw Forky. Yeah. And Lightning McQueen.
So this is like, I don't think kids are listening to the podcast, but for parents, this is like a superpower, right? Oh, I lost video.
Yeah, we can't see you.
Let me see. I'll change it to a different camera. This is a superpower, right? Like, watch these videos and then draw Forky for your kids.
Yeah.
And maybe teach them, and their minds will be blown.
I love it.
All right. So you think that. So I watched the Lightning McQueen one, and I was like, I got this. They made it look so easy. I could do this. No problem. And then I sketched something, and it might as well have looked like a bucket. I don't know. It was just like, it is not as easy as they make it look.
It's this classic meme, right? Where like, how to draw this character, and it's like, well, the first, you draw a circle.
Right.
Second, you draw like the two crisscross lines. And third, it's done.
Yeah.
Right. Like, nope. It's much more than that. It's years and years of work.
I can do the first two steps.
Yeah.
This actually dovetails with the whole Disney at home thing, because at California Adventure, you can take a drawing class. I don't know if you guys ever did this, but you can go into a room, sign up, and get in the line. And my kids did this several times, and we actually really liked it. You can go in, and a Disney animator will teach you how to draw the character of the hour, and it's just like this. So this is super cool. I did not know about this, and I'll be passing it on. I think I'm going to actually pass the links on rather than fool them into thinking I'm talented.
Well, no, you should go watch the video, practice it once or twice, do the magic trick of, hey, kids, look what dad can do. Like, pick a character out of Toy Story 4. Maybe a Canadian character. Maybe a Daredevil. Oh, do Kaboom. Okay. Oh, here you go. Do Kaboom. And they'll be blown away. Speaking of the learning in a box thing, Khan Academy has an Imagineering in a box lesson. And it's this amazing series from Imagineers about how they design their rides. So totally, it's a free cool course that you can just watch. But if you just search Khan Academy, Imagineering in a box, under their storytelling category, and if you have time to spare, go watch that.
Also, while you're at the Pixar YouTube channel, they 2 hours ago they posted WALL-E in 16-bit, which is a 2.5-minute retelling of WALL-E in Super Nintendo style, and it's awesome.
Wait, and they animated this? Like,
Who knows? Like, quarantine, man. I have no idea. At the end, it says, like, now streaming. So I don't know if it's actually a promotion and WALL-E just ended up on Disney Plus, but there you go. It's there for you.
Oh, It's kind of like the Frozen short where they had the knit sweater animated storytelling of the Frozen story, if you remember that.
No.
They did it in kind of like knit sweater style, so it looked like the characters were moving on a sweater.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've watched a lot of Frozen these days. I'm going to give two shout-outs on Disney Plus. If you haven't seen these, the Pixar story and Waking Sleeping Beauty, and I think they're on Netflix also, are documentaries that were made years ago now. I think the Pixar one was made in 2007, and Waking Sleeping Beauty was made in 2010, but about the similar eras. One, of course, how Pixar came about, all the way from Toy Story 1 to, I want to say, Ratatouille, and then Waking Sleeping Beauty, about the years between 1984 and 1994, when they released Oliver and Company to Lion King, and that kind of golden era, the second golden era of Disney movies. So both of those are wonderful documentaries. It's amazing to think that there's more time has passed since the founding of Pixar and that film than now, or not the founding of Pixar, but the release of the film, Toy Story.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. So we're due for another Pixar documentary update to talk about the second half of the company so far. Mandalorian season 3 has been greenlit as a new report. So season 2, I think they finished filming, not out obviously, but no surprise, they're going to do season 3. It's been a huge success for them. And then in the Star Wars universe, we're going to pivot to Lego. Lego announced a new UCS kit. This is their Ultimate Collector series. They're really polished, high quality number of parts. And it's going to be the A-Wing Starfighter, $200, available on May 1st, 1,673 pieces.
I saw a lot of comments on this feedback saying, oh, it's the spaceship nobody wanted. Why did you do that? And I was all like, I'm kind of into this. I like
A-Wing's
A-Wing.
Gorgeous.
A-Wing's awesome.
Okay, thank you.
Those people are wrong.
I mean, yes, the Y-Wing, I think, has the most like external Greeblies, and there was a UCS Y-Wing. It's no longer production. The B-Wing, there's a lot of love for the B-Wing because of the unique design, but the A-Wing is classic, the rounded corners, and to do that in Lego, like they have these nice rounded pieces. Obviously, their CG box art, is super nicely lit, but it's going to be massive.
This
this set. And it's and classic.
Not,
yeah.
And not monotone, which, like, nothing against the Star Destroyer, but, like, I like a little bit of color in my models. So this is, I think it looks great.
Yeah, the red stripe down the center. Yeah, it's a classic. You can hold it and, you know, fly it around and go pew pew, right? But it's also $200. But May 1st, just in time for, you know, May
4th.
Exactly. Last bit, Lego. Adam built the Lego ISS. He did it as a video last week. I still have to build that, but there are now lighting kits for that. And a friend of Tested, friend of Adam, Sasha Judd, did a blog post about her build of the Lego ISS model. And she took the original kit, she took the lighting brick, the light kit from Light My Bricks, and then married them and then programmed it so the ISS Lego set lit up when the real ISS goes overhead.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And she has shared the code for this.
All right, Sasha wins the internet for today.
It was done with an Arduino Uno Wi-Fi, and she has the sketch where you can just copy the code, and the lighting set looks great. You know, it lights up not only the ISS, but the little shuttle that comes with it, and it's a really, really fun project. And it's a blog post on her website, sasajud.com, and we'll put a link in the description.
You can get events from If This Then That for when it flies over your house. So if you are a coder of any sort, like, there's easy ways to tap into that. That's a brilliant use of it.
Yeah, yeah. I think she did tap into use a version of that. And then have you guys seen Tales from the Loop?
Yeah, I actually saw it.
How many episodes?
One. I mean, that's good, right?
Yeah, I saw two.
Great.
Do you want to talk about it?
I watched it with my son. It's like an hour long. It's episode one. And I thought it was beautiful. I mean, it's first and foremost, appropriately, kind of painterly. Like, it's an artistic, series. And it's all very visual. And I like how the technology kind of fades into the background. It's not like the focus of the shots, but it is definitely oddly futuristic. And things are happening that are unexplainable. And I get the sense that the series is sort of like The Amazing Stories or Twilight Zone, where it doesn't follow the same characters story to story, episode to episode.
If you watch the first two episodes back to back, it really gives you a sense of what they're going for. It is anthology in that sense, but some characters you meet in the first episode become the main characters of the second episode. And they kind of is a chain that way. So characters that become, or background characters or secondary characters, become the focus. And so it's all about this town. The idea is that it's based on concept art. This artist, Simon Stellenhag, and I'm butchering his name, he's released a couple books. One was called Tales from the Loop, one was Electric State. And he has, like, these matte paintings of, like, these otherworldly alternate universes. And in this case, it's, you know, an alternate 1980s middle America. I think it's set in Iowa, and it's a world where 1980s middle America lives alongside some futuristic robot, you know, or mysterious technology filled with robots and giant buildings and really kind of like Soviet looking mechanical pieces. And the idea behind this TV show is they just took concept art, that art, and said, and told the writers, what story does this art tell you? And then they created a completely original story based on the art. So every episode is based on one piece of art. And then they connected it all together and invented characters of this town to have some type of narrative.
Yeah.
I think it's a little slow. I think it would have been fine as a half hour show, was my only criticism.
Yeah, I kind of had that sense that a lot of people who are accustomed to, like, modern entertainment might think that, you know, because it is slow paced. But I kind of appreciated it as an alternative to Marvel films and that kind of, you know, excitement factor that we've been so accustomed to. It takes its time with some shots and really is really, really a beautifully shot and edited production. And I was taken aback by how it went down a spooky route, but then kind of pivoted into this just more of a sweet kind of sentimentality. And it's so, in that sense, it reminded me of Amazing Stories as well as sort of Twilight Zone. Was the second episode the same kind of tone?
Very same, similar. Okay. It has a little bit of wistfulness to it.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of melancholy, but like also a mix of melancholy and childlike wonder, I think is the tone they're going for. And they linger on those shots because they want the shots themselves to kind of evoke the feeling of the illustrations that you see from his concept art. Right.
Right.
Every shot is like a slow push in, beautifully framed. And it's a gorgeous show to look at for sure. But I do think it's 50% atmosphere, 50% story. And so not a lot happens in each episode, but the way in which it unfolds very slowly is very beautiful.
Yeah. We had discussed it when it was announced, I think. And, mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't have watched it, but my friend Chris, texted me and said he highly recommended it. So it's, yeah, I was glad that he did because I thought it was pretty great.
Well, it's nice to know that you take recommendations from other people, but just not us on this podcast.
I need two opinions.
Two, okay. Because sure, you gotta join with me on this. Yeah. Okay. That's it for pop culture. So good news, guys. I have not spent $300 to buy the Apple Magic Keyboard. I saved myself $300.
Good news for you. Bad news for everyone else.
Well, I don't think, yeah. In thinking about it, you know, it not worth the purchase. Apple, like we talked about last week, not only released this, but also announced new iPhone SE, and reviews for both these devices are out now. It seems like on the Magic Keyboard side, guess what? It's another way to get you to spend money if you feel like you haven't given Apple enough money yet. Sounds like it's a great keyboard, but it makes the iPad thicker and heavier than the 13-inch MacBook Pro.
Well, when it's attached.
When it's attached, yes, yes. The Verge did a really good review of it, which their reviewer compared it to the Surface in the sense of the design approaches. And it really resonated with me, but the Surface device is something that you can also detach as a tablet or mm-hmm. buy Microsoft's design keyboard for, specifically the Surface X, right? Which is the ARM-based one that runs Windows. But Surface as a device was designed as laptop first, which is why we've always called the Surface a laptop, but you could use it in a tablet form factor, which makes if you're spending, you know, upwards of $1,500 or $1,000 or $2,000 all in with the pen and the device itself and all the accessories, more usable if you're someone who wants to use it as a laptop. Whereas the iPad is something that definitely is tablet first, but is usable and laptop like form factor with accessories, but you're going to be missing, because iOS is not macOS, all the things that you would take for granted in macOS. No matter how much money you throw at at making it like a laptop, it is not a laptop in the way you would normally think about the laptop.
Yet.
Yeah. And maybe that's Apple's strategy, right? Maybe they don't care about how people think about laptops and what, you know, Mac users, and Mac will be just a small subset of their market, but they know that way more kids are growing up with iPads, and, you know, designing a device that is tablet and iPad friendly and still the best tablet you can buy right now first is a better business decision.
It's interesting that they put that trackpad on there, because that is putting it right in the front of the user, and yet it's a feature you have to turn on in accessibilities. So
I think it's turned on automatically if you put the iPad on.
Interesting.
On the Magic Keyboard. But all the reviews say, while the cursor support works great on the Surface level, on the OS level, and on native Apple apps, third-party apps have not really done a great job adopting it. And
yeah.
It's inconsistent there. Yeah. And the trackpad's real small. If you're used mm-hmm. to the big trackpad, you know, it's a $300 plus keyboard. If you really wanted something that made the iPad like a dock, like a workstation, right? You can buy a stand. You can buy the Apple Magic Keyboard separately, like just the keyboard itself. And you could buy, they have the $130 big trackpad, the glass trackpad. Right, you could buy all three of those for under $300 and have essentially the same thing. Yes, it won't be like a lappable thing, but I don't see people using this on airplanes.
I don't see people using this on their lap. Do you?
Yeah. I mean, the idea is that you could, But I think you're right. I think it really is a put on your desk.
Yeah.
It makes it a workstation. That's why they
frame it on the wall because it's that expensive. Yeah, yeah, I get it.
Shadow box it. Exactly. Exactly. iPhone SE reviews are as expected. You know, the A13 processor is great. And it's just the dated form factor, but a lot of people won't care about that because that price point. The other news or the rumor is that Apple is supposed to have an SE and an SE Plus, a bigger size one, but they delayed the release of the SE Plus because of demand and because of manufacturing due to COVID. But you know, $400 for the fastest Apple processor with a so-so camera that's good in daylight, but not so great in low light, is exactly what you pay for.
So the only thing that that comes up is, size aside, do you think people are going to push back because it's not true, like edge to edge is like, it's not like the screen isn't all the way. It's like a return back to like, you know, the 6.7 kind of style.
I think there are plenty of people out there who are totally fine with that 4.7 inch screen and don't need the edge to edge and just want to be able to use WeChat, you know, games on their phone and make good phone calls and not have to pay $600, $700, $800, $1,000 for an iPhone, but want to be in the iOS ecosystem still.
I don't imagine too many people with an edge-to-edge Apple phone are upgrading to this phone. Like, I think they're waiting for this fall's phones.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely not. Like, unlike the previous SE, where a lot of people love the form factor of the iPhone 5 and went from the 6 form factor to the 5 because of the SE and the fast, you know, the updated processor. That was a byproduct of this decision to use an old manufacturing, you know, the old molds and to here, it's clearly an entry level budget phone to get people into iOS.
But by the by, is Face ID basically going to be dead now given the social changes with masks and everything else that's coming?
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
No, I tweeted about this yesterday, and I asked people, you know, do you think that Apple, with the next phone, because presumably iPhone 12 is already designed and will probably go into manufacturing relatively soon, right? They probably designed it with Face ID first in mind. I don't think there's any way they're going to go back to Touch ID, even like a beneath the screen Touch ID, because this is a short-term problem that would need to be solved in their minds.
Could they apply a computer learning to recognize people through masks? Because I can recognize people through masks.
So that's a security question, because the whole idea of Face ID is that it was accurate enough that you could not fool it with just, you know, a picture of yourself or just your eyes. And you're talking about the geometry of just half your face with glasses. The reason that was accurate was because it also had the lower half of your face and could adapt and model. So they would have to consciously lower the security threshold of Face ID. And I think they're going to do it in a seamless way so that when you set up, it'll just say it recognized, you know, with deep learning, you're wearing a mask and it'll have a low security mask mode. Maybe it'll be geofence. When you leave the house, Face ID works and unlocks when you have a mask on, but when you're at home, you need the full face or something like that. You know, it's going to be kind of a deal with it way. Face ID is still going to be there. They're not going to say, don't turn off Face ID. Just use your numpad.
The current generation Face ID scanning is actually fairly low resolution in terms of like the dots that it maps onto your face. If they could increase that high enough, I wouldn't be surprised if like the high end phone this fall could keep an equal a nice level of security, as well as maybe only detect faces using the top half of the face. Maybe
that's a question for security researchers, right?
Like whatever they choose, it has to work perfectly. Like it like basically has to be like 98% or above or something,
right?
And so I don't like the testing that they'll have to do to make what you're talking about work, Norm, is pretty extensive. And even though it's on the software side of things, so it's probably not going to be disruptive to any supply chain kind of elements, I wonder if they're going to be able to pull it off in like the few months that they have.
Maybe it's something they'll need to address.
I wonder, because I've been doing Apple Pay, but I use my watch and it works great. I double tap the button, I move my hand over there, contactless payments. And I wonder if there'll be more applications that will incorporate wearing a watch into Face ID instead of using Face ID.
Which is what works with your laptop right now, right? Or right. Your iMac. You wear them, this proximity to your watch is what allows you to unlock. And that's a seamless thing. And, you know, regardless, it's something they'll have to address. They can't say up front, like, spend $400 on a watch to get your security to be convenient for your phone that you spent $1,000 for.
They can't.
I mean, they can't. They're not going to say it out loud. They just build that feature in and let people feel like their lives haven't been disrupted.
Nor will they say that they had to compromise security.
Right. They'll just say, it just works. It just works whether you wear a mask or not, and you'll feel just as confident. You know, their whole thing is that Face ID isn't it's a deterrent, but it's not a all-encompassing, you know, biometric security lockbox. Alexa.
Oh, don't
Alexa
do that.
Is getting a new... Sorry. Amazon's security assistant or voice digital assistant has a new voice.
This is dumb. I mean, this is really a dumb story because I don't know if you listened to it. They made a long form speaking voice for her because some people listen to Wikipedia entries, for instance, and it doesn't sound all that different. She just sounds slightly less excited. Did you find that?
I felt the same way. I had to listen to it like 3 or 4 times before I could tell the difference between the two. And like the idea is like when you say long form, really what they did is just made the speech more conversational. Like there's a slightly less like abrupt pauses in between some of the words. So it feels a little bit more natural, but it's very, very subtle.
Shall we listen?
I guess so.
All right, sure. I'm gonna play this for a second. Give me 1 second. Here is it's gonna be the neutral, usual speaking voice first, and then we'll hear the long form. Here's the neutral one.
Meet Echo Dot. Our most popular Echo is now even better. With a new speaker and design, Echo Dot is a voice-controlled smart speaker with Alexa, perfect for any room. Just ask for music, news.
All right, that was the neutral one. Here's the long form style.
Meet Echo Dot. Our most popular Echo is now even better. With a new speaker and design, Echo Dot is a voice-controlled smart speaker with Alexa, perfect for any room.
It's like
you guys are right.
She's been given a sedative, you know?
She's a little more chilled out.
Yeah.
Celebrating 420 a little bit. The other question is, you know, If we look at science fiction as an example, natural language devices like the Star Trek computer, there was always this artificially stilted enunciation and performance when they had, Ms. Roddenberry, do the voice, because that telegraphed to viewers that it was a computer voice. Is that something that we want, or do we want something that sounds like, you know, the AI in the Friday AI on Tony Stark's, you know, Jarvis replacement?
Are you joking? Of course we want that. We want Jarvis. We want Scarlett Johansson in her. But we don't have that yet, and it's nowhere on the horizon. And so smart science fiction incorporates, you know, imperfections.
But I do think what we just heard shows the kind of incremental pace that we're likely to see now. We went from like zero to where we are so rapidly that we're like, wow, we're on our way to Jarvis, but we are like really just feeling how long it is to Jarvis now.
Exactly.
So I just don't expect to see like much in terms of my like daily activity, like a lot of massive changes. And I don't think any of those things are going to start joking around with me and taking sarcastic jibes at me like Jarvis does.
Well, that's the other thing. Like when you have intonation in a computer voice, there's intention and personality there. That's more than just, there's subtext there. That's more than just the words on the page. So the example here is for when people listen to long form Wikipedia. And you know, when you're talking about the encyclopedia and just factual information, you kind of need and want that to be monotone. Right, but something that sounds natural, but the ability to have inflection and intonation is a huge challenge for natural language, for computer voices, because that's extra layers that you can't just type in, right? You need to actually you know, skew and tell the voice, this is what I mean when I want the computer voice to say this sentence.
You know, the same Verge article that we're reading this from links to a story from last year on her reading styles of news, which is actually more impressive. Like, that actually pushes her intonation abilities much further, where she can sound disappointed or elated, you know, as much as she can.
But stop politicizing Alexa.
And so, like, it's definitely possible. It's I love seeing the progress. I just think this update is not all that impressive.
I mean, should a computer voice sound like it has an, you know,
emotion,
exactly, right? Like, and like subtext behind the things they're saying, or like, should a computer voice just relay the information?
The first computer voice that I'm aware of in pop culture would be Hal, and that is a completely emotionless voice, I think intentionally, just, you know, especially given the context of some of the scenes.
It's an emotionless voice that brims with emotion, like the impact upon you.
Right. Yeah.
So you need like a base level of neutrality, of emotion, but neutral emotion, so that you don't reach the uncanny valley of it being, you know, reading into the inhumanness, the sinisterness of Hal, but maybe not go as far as to distort the meanings of the words.
I love the idea of uncanny valley existing in the sounds. That's interesting.
In voice. Yeah. Something that we're going to have to figure out. This is the fun part. I mean, you know, it's a normal news story, but it's fun thinking about it. We were big fans of Boosted. Jeremy, you big fan of Boosted Board. You have one.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it sounds like they are no more.
Oh, they are no more. Yeah, they have let go of their staff. Well, Lime has purchased all of their assets and their IP. And this is Lime Scooters, the people who, you know, have a rental, you know, scooters across many cities. And they have bought what remains of Boosted, sadly, and owns the company and all of the IP. And it remains to be seen what they're going to be doing with any of the outstanding support requests and how they'll be supporting Boosted products. But yeah, it's kind of a sad thing. I mean, Boosted started out as one of the great Kickstarter stories and was really early to market in the electric skateboarding scene. And so I think that gave them a huge advantage, and they were able to survive and do great things for years because of first to market, as well as having a really superior product. Like, it was very expensive. And then competition came on with cheaper boards, but they were able to survive because they had that first-to-market advantage. But this scooter that they came out with last year, I think, hurt them because they were not first-to-market with that. And it was, again, one of the most expensive options. And so that was difficult for them to bear, as well as the trade tariffs. It's sad. It's definitely a sad thing because they made great products. They really did, and they're manufactured right here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and it was one of those product categories that because it became a commodity product, everyone had them, just like, you know, Segway and the hoverboards, right? Reliability was one of the things that you could trust with this company, where you would be less certain of that with a cheaper board.
Yeah. Thankfully the Reddit community has stepped up to offer, you know, support to users who still have boards and are looking to keep them running. So there's a community there. If you are a board rider, you might want to check them out and tap and get to know some of those good people.
Do we know what Lime is going to do with the remnant stock? Are they going to sell it, or we don't know at this point?
We don't know. There's a lot of people who worked at Boosted, at least in senior positions, who have moved to Lime, a lot being, you know, less than 10, but still some considerable number. And so that there's some of the Boosted DNA is at Lime, and I assume they're rooting for Boosted support of some kind.
Yeah.
The former CEO and founder of Boosted actually posted a Reddit thread on the day that this was all announced, if you want to Google that.
Yeah, it's a serious bummer. I mean, especially from their perspective as an entrepreneur, you know, creating this really well-known company and really reputable one, that just, yeah, didn't work out. Last week we talked about the possibility of Crysis coming back with a tweet from the Crysis account. This is the video game from over a decade ago now, and it is. Crysis is being remastered and coming out later this year to PC, and it's going to have higher resolution textures and PC, PS4, Xbox One, and for the first time on Nintendo Switch. So that's interesting. But not only will it have higher resolution textures, but will also have ray tracing. And this is interesting because the ray tracing will be a part of their native Cry engine, and it'll be API agnostic, so will not be limited to like the NVIDIA RTX boards, presumably older NVIDIA cards and AMD cards, and maybe even Intel's cards, as long as they're beefy enough, will be able to run the new Crysis.
That's amazing.
Looking forward to playing.
I don't even know, like, is it something that younger gamers are aware of? Like, Crysis was the benchmark game. Like, that's why this phrase, "Does it run Crysis?" is a meme. It's like a popular thing because it for years, it was like you could run it on a new system, and if you cranked the levels up far enough, you could bring your system to its threshold. So it's cool. I don't know. Were you a fan of the game? Like, I was never a huge fan of Far Cry or Crysis.
Oh, so yeah, the history, Crytek developers previously did Far Cry, which was super groundbreaking as a FPS way back. And I remember, and Far Cry, of course, became its own thing, right? Far Cry 2 was separate developers, but kind of this open world action game before the likes of Just Cause, right? Like very physics based. And I remember reviewing Crysis. I didn't do the review, but I was at EA with Chuck Osborne, who did the review for PC Gamer, and it blew us away. I mean, it was, yes, graphically incredibly impressive, but the superpowered aspects to it, they had this whole Predator feel where you felt like you were like this superhuman agent that could cloak, but you had this, you know, you had this, it was a stealth game. It was Metal Gear Solid or like the Predator and Predator vs. Aliens, where you had to fight these, you know, this military base and scope out the enemies and judiciously use your powers, your superpowers, one at a time to infiltrate this island base. And it was, you know, driving the vehicles, the ability to basically destroy trees and grab people and throw things. All the physics stuff was really, really groundbreaking at the time. I have fond memories of it, and I'll be going back.
Cool.
Something that does require RTX cards for ray tracing is Minecraft, and there's now a beta out for Minecraft with ray tracing, and you can download it out if you have a RTX card, and all the screenshots look incredible, although performance is, as expected, terrible with ray tracing.
I don't know if they look incredible. This really reminds me of like when people turned on 3D acceleration with like Quake or something.
Yeah, and it looked incredible. Colored lighting back then? Yeah,
but it didn't look like what the designers had in mind, right? It looked like something new, and it looked like new tech, you know, something that had potential to be amazing if applied by an artist, but it didn't look intentional. And so that's what this looks like to me. And so it's cool from a technical standpoint, but I don't know if it looks great.
It's, I mean, the reflections in the water.
Yeah.
The kind of the light effects, right? The haze effects through the trees. The fact that they do this with like there are screenshots where you see these blocky trees and you have the light cast, like the rays cast through the squares of the branches, right? To cast these like fuzzy but perfectly blurred rectangles on the ground. That looks super cool. It's the best Minecraft can look today without taking away from the classic Minecraft aesthetic.
Okay.
I think it's neat. And Engadget's review, it said that with their RTX 2080 Ti at 1080p, basically about 53 FPS.
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow. Can it run Minecraft?
Yeah, no.
That doesn't bode well for like the PS5 and the Xbox X, right?
I think they're going to use ray tracing very judiciously. And again, it's like, just like Crysis, can it run Crysis still applies today because it wasn't optimized and it hasn't. It's an engine that brute forced a lot of its rendering with all its SSAO and all the physics stuff. Like, optimized versions and cheats around that stuff are the way to get them to maximize all the benefits of ray tracing without having to make every scene and every light source. Like, Control did it with only certain light sources. And so it's going to be a mix of the baked lighting and ray trace lighting and the stuff they're doing now. Speaking of RTX improvements, if you have an RTX card, NVIDIA also last week enabled something called RTX Voice, which uses the GPU to process incoming and outgoing audio and eliminate background noise using GPU compute. It's like for live streamers who want to take away from clacky keyboards. So the idea is that if you're going to spend that money on an expensive graphics card, maybe you're a mechanical keyboard person, and maybe your Twitch audience doesn't want to hear your clacky mechanical keyboards, well, you can turn this on, and that will take it away.
You know what I would really like for this to do, and then maybe getting rid of the clacky keyboard is the first step, but I would like to see it enhance the audio, not just remove background noise, but actually flesh out the curve and, you know, deepen voices and give better, you know, tone. That would be nice. Like, so that people, we're moving away from studios left and right here. Like, you link to tools that allows you to use your iPhone as an OBS camera and do multi-camera shoots at home really easily. Like, it would be nice if we didn't need an awesome microphone or mixer or some sort of EQ to sound good. So hopefully this is that direction.
And my hope that these are things that can meet in the middle, right? Just like computational vision can create really cool bokeh-like effects for smartphone cameras, I don't think that's going to be a replacement for, you know, for real lenses and the real physics of lighting. Same with, you know, condenser mics and pop filters. While a lot of that stuff can be software and done in real time with software to make it sound good, you're still going to want a good hardware if you want the best in the high end. I don't want, I guess, recording artists to be recording on their Yeti snowballs, right, while at home and creating master tracks with post-processing.
No, I just want every Twitch stream to sound as good as possible.
Yeah, and audio is one of those things that, you know, bad audio is something that will break a video more than good audio will help save a video.
Yep.
Yes, create raise the floor on quality, I guess. Mm-hmm. All right, now we move on to probably the most important segment. I've been waiting for this. Let's get to a moment of science.
Moment of science.
I played the wrong one. That was the old one.
Oh, well, I'm just going to have to go with a jaunty, upbeat moment of science, I guess. I want to talk about antibody testing, because that's going to become a thing that you hear a lot more about. So first, just like a primer on how antibody testing works. So antibodies are like Y-shaped proteins that are made typically by B cells, white blood cells, when it detects something called an antigen in your body, some foreign substance that it's reacting to. These Y-shaped proteins go seek out that pathogen, that invader, and try to latch onto it. So in the case of a coronavirus, the Y-shaped antibody tries to latch onto one of those spike proteins that I talked about last week. Now, there's a couple different types of antibodies that typically appear with infections, particularly infections from coronaviruses. There's IgM, which stands for immunoglobulin M, which usually appears within the early site of an infection and then drops off. And then IgG, which tends to appear later in infections and then persist for a long time and is typically associated with having a longer immune response and protection from an invader. So now there's two things when you're doing an antibody test that you're potentially trying to look for. You're either trying to look for the IgM or the IgG. Now, when those antibodies come, it variant depending on the nature of the actual virus. So in the case of coronavirus, we're just starting to get information now of when those antibodies start to appear. So really early evidence, and this is still changing, is that IgM becomes detectable about 7 days in. So if Jeremy, if you get infected with SARS-CoV-2, typically like 0 to 5 days, you're going to be asymptomatic. And I say typically meaning like this is just like a very loose average. Everyone is presenting differently. Somewhere between 5 and 10 days, you'll start to see the onset of symptoms if you actually proceed from asymptomatic into actually developing COVID-19. IgM first becomes detectable by most tests around day 7. Around day 14 is when IgM tends to peak, and then it falls off and typically disappears. Again, typically very loosely here, around day 21. So about 3 weeks, after about 3 weeks, IgM is gone. So you only have this window from about day 7 to 21 to find the IgM. Now, IgG tends to start to show up about 2 weeks in, and then we haven't seen it decline in anyone yet. So a lot of antibody tests are already kind of out there on the market. The FDA has approved a bunch of them, and there's a bunch from foreign sources that are being used. But they have to be able to detect the right antibody. And I think the more important one is to detect the IgG variant, because that's the one that tells us about kind of over a longer period of time, who's potentially had this, as a way of developing an analysis and epidemiology of how many infections there are. So here in the Bay Area where we live, there was a Stanford study that made a lot of news, where they put out Facebook ads for this study, that you could drive up to Stanford, they would take a prick of your blood, and within a few days return results on whether, based off of your antibody test, like if you potentially had this. And their idea was, if we got 3,000 or so people from Santa Clara, San Mateo counties, we could kind of back calculate how many people might have been affected. And out of that, they said, well, we found infection rate of 1.5%. But then they said, because we use Facebook ads, we did these like kind of demographic kind of weighting to figure out what it really would have been if we had gotten a representative sample, and said, it's probably between 2% and 4%. Most epidemiologists thought their analysis was wrong for a number of reasons, that they weighted it too high, et cetera. But the analysis that came out is like, well, if we take that 2% to 4%, take the number of cases in Santa Clara County, and compare it to what 2% to 4% of the Santa Clara population would be, what came out is that, we're undercounting by like a factor of 50, which is crazy, right? Now, there are problems with that study. You should not take like that number as being gospel. I think most scientists think the number is somewhere between 5 and 10 times, as opposed to like 50 times. But that's the power of antibody tests. It's not so much that it can tell you, Jeremy, if you've had it. But what it does tell is, over the population, it can give us an idea. And the reason that that's important is, there's two kind of components to an antibody test that are really important: sensitivity and specificity. So sensitivity is how likely, what's the percentage chance that it's going to report a true positive test. Like if you have a disease, it comes back and says you're positive, and it's confirmed that you actually are positive. And then there's specificity, which is, what's the true negative rate? Like if it says you don't have the disease, what's the percent that is right? Those numbers have been calculated by the manufacturers of these tests, but they haven't been like entirely verified in the field yet. So you'll see, like, the tests that Stanford used, which came from this group called Premier Biotech, reported a sensitivity rate of 99.5%. But there's been independent testing that calls that into question and says it's maybe closer to like 92 to 95%. Each percentage drop that I'm talking about, which could relate more false positives, is a massive shift in the percentage that they project out would have it within a county. And so right now we're seeing these antibody tests relay sensitivity rates in this like low to mid 90 region. That's not good enough for us to get the kind of analysis that we need. So there's a bunch of groups running these antibody surveys everywhere in this country. So New York has one going, there's one in Southern California, that USC ran, that I saw a press release about. They haven't even published the data yet. You'll see a bunch of these going on across the country. The CDC is running these. Until that number around the sensitivity rises up, it's hard to say what's going on. And then the other side is, like, the specificity number also has to be high. Otherwise, we can't glean what the population level data actually is. all that being said, like I took you into some of the technical details around the antibody test. We need this antibody test to really understand how many people have had it, because it's a clue to how much testing are we going to need going forward as we start to kind of start to tackle the problem of what does it look like for the next, you know, year to 2 years as a treatment and therapeutic is developed. Right now, like the best guess I've seen from epidemiologists, they don't know. It's going to vary by region, but they think the prevalence here in the U.S. is going to be somewhere like in that 1-5% area. You know, in New York City, it's probably going to be a lot higher than it is in San Francisco because it was spreading more rapidly there. But I, you know, whether it's 1% or 2% or 3%, there's going to be a lot of scientists that are arguing about that. You know, to you and me, it probably doesn't matter that much. Because the number that is really at the end of the day that's important is like, what does it take for us to have herd immunity with that percentage? That number is largely considered somewhere between 66 and 70% of the population. So if we're at 1, 2, 3, 4, that means we're still a whole lot long way away. So you'll see reporting about when the first death was in Santa Clara County. You'll see stories about antibody testing, giving prevalence rates. You're going to see all this kind of information come out that's going to drive like certain news narratives. And I think you should just take a step back away from all that stuff and say, what is that really telling us? If it tells us like the numbers are really important for science, but for you and me living our everyday life, it's not a big difference between 2 and 3%. What really matters is us getting to the point where we have confidence in those numbers, because that starts to illustrate the pathway out of here. And if you're going to read something long form in Science this week about testing, antibody testing, PCR testing, whatever you want, it's Harvard put out essentially a pandemic response plan that is about, it's 50 pages long. I've read it. It's it actually lays out pretty simply what we need to do. And their case is these antibody tests are going to be part of it, but we just need to ramp testing overall. Probably about 3 to 4 times where it is in this country. We need to be doing like between 450,000 and 500,000 tests a day, where we're seeing positive rates where they typically are between 10 and 20% in a lot of locations in this country, come down to like 3-4%. Because at that level, we can start to see, we can start to make public policy changes where if you go out to a restaurant or if you go to a local business, the chance of you contracting the disease goes way down. And then public health measures like washing your hands, wearing a mask, all of that kind of stuff can further reduce it. But if it's at like 10, 20% where they have no idea how much of it is out there, it makes it really, really hard to recommend people going out to those businesses because they just don't know. We just won't know. And we won't have a way of finding those people because there won't be infrastructure there. So that was a long way around of saying like, there's no panacea in antibody tests right now. It's going to be a long pathway and it's going to be murky and you're going to hear a lot of numbers. But until those numbers start to really collapse into something pretty consistent, I'm going to treat it, I'm personally going to treat it as a little bit of noise right now. That's antibody testing.
It doesn't surprise me that cases are underreported because as far as I know, across the country, doctors are just recommending people stay at home if they feel symptomatic. And they're
Of course there's an undercount. Yeah.
And so
it's not just the stay home. It's there's a large percentage of people that are getting the virus that don't get sick. And even if you don't get sick, you'll probably develop the antibodies for it.
So that
it may affect what your immunity is long-term, but I mean, that part we just don't know right now.
That was my question. Is there any evidence, I've seen this question asked and I haven't heard a good answer. Is there any evidence to suggest that the severity of your symptoms is related to how much of the virus you're exposed to?
So, okay, so like the question is, the answer is really, we don't know. There's some early indication based off of how healthcare workers have gotten sick and their higher likelihood of getting sick, that dosage of the virus matters, but we don't know if that's a dosage thing, like being exposed to more virus gets you more likely to get sick. I mean, some part of that is kind of intuitive, or if there is something about the time at which the health that people are sick, that is a more highly transmissible state for the people that are sick. And so healthcare workers are dealing with the most transmissible type of person. There's been some analysis that looked at what the transmission rate is in terms of days. And there's this period late in your asymptomatic area. It's usually like the last 2 days of when you're asymptomatic to when you start developing symptoms, that like 4 day period in there that you're most transmissible right now. That's just our data on that is changing all the time. So I can't say if that's because of viral load or if it's the high transmissible rate, but we see this early evidence that healthcare workers are more likely to get sick than the general population, which points to something.
Yeah. And all this is like a macro picture as to why antibody testing matters for every all the reasons you said. But I think a lot of people are also focusing on like what it means for someone who gets antibody tests, like, and what they individually can take away from that. And it sounds like a takeaway from that is that there is no actionable takeaway.
Yeah, if I took an antibody test and got a result, I wouldn't take my antibody test result, especially if I took it right now, as gospel of whether I had this or not. I just don't believe in the specificity and the sensitivity of the number to tell me something either way. But if you do that 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000, 100,000 people, it tells you a lot over that kind of high population. And that's the number we need for some of these bigger public policy decisions that need to be made. So antibodies tests right now, I don't think tell us a ton. I hope that changes. And I hope that changes rapidly as the tests get better, because the test itself isn't that complicated and it's really, really fast. It's usually just like a pinprick, a drop of blood. And then as the, it looks for like the shape of the virus to bind to these certain receptors as it flows across the plate. And when it does, it changes colors. So it's not so different from the experience of like a pregnancy test, as opposed to peeing on a stick, you put a drop of blood and see a color change. So it can be really, really fast. But until that sensitivity and specificity rate are really top-notch and verified, it's hard to draw a lot of conclusions.
And it also sounds like it's inconclusive as to whether having the antibodies means that you are immune for X number future, you know, however long this will go on.
We have no idea on that. And this is a really scary thing, is we've been operating under the assumption, because this is how, you know, a lot of immunity works with coronaviruses or just any viruses, is that if you get it and you get better, you're going to have immunity for some period of time. Whether it's a year or two or lifelong, that's kind of the place we operate on. We don't have proof of that yet. And it's not that we don't have proof of that, like, or the opposite. Like we know that that doesn't happen. We don't have that either. It's just too early to know. And so are we going to have protection over a long period of time for those that are sick? I think for anyone that listened to The Daily this week, where Don McNeil was on, the reporter from, longtime health reporter from the New York Times, probably one of the earliest like canary in the coal mines about this whole thing, where like in February, he was like, oh, we're in trouble, you know, in a really big way. And the world is in trouble, where he was saying, we don't know about immunity and we have to plan as if it to a certain extent that we're not going to get this like perfect immunity for those that are sick. But also we have to look at history, and what history says is like when we've encountered this in the past, like chicken pox, flu pandemics, like people will have parties to get intentionally sick and try to get a lower strain, whatever you want to call it, like a lower, you know, virulent form of the disease. Like, you can expect that to happen. That's going to be crazy when it emerges. But like, that's a natural situation that we know from history. It'll likely happen now. I hope it doesn't, because it's really, really dangerous. But, you know, it's a natural response when you take the idea of immunity and sort of press it forward. We just don't have enough information to make some clear statements around that. I suspect there's going to be some immunity for some period of time for those that have recovered, just based off of what we know of how other viruses have worked, especially other coronaviruses. The how long is just a massive question here. And until we get that data, we can't make certain decisions. So in a way, this is a race to buy us more time for a therapeutic to come online, or buy us more time for a vaccine to come online, which are not simple things.
I mean,
because how do you make 5 billion, 7 billion doses of a vaccine? Because that's right. I mean, even if you just look at it in this country, how do you make 330 million doses of a vaccine?
Right, right. Yeah, I remember that movie Contagion. It was a lottery, right? You just have to dole it out and get on your date, you get your vaccine. But one of the striking things is, you know, for all the technological advances and improvements in communication and education, you know, what people were doing 100 years ago is being mirrored today, just the reactions and behaviors and societal behaviors.
Yeah, I think a month ago on this podcast, I talked about the Anti-Mask League of San Francisco that emerged in 1918. And I meant it from in the vein of, like, we're probably going to see pushback and we're probably going to see, like, some version of protest. We saw a version of that this week in the U.S. We're probably going to see more push and pull like that. I mean, we're dealing with human choices here, which don't follow, like, these perfect regimented guidelines. People are going to make their own decision. But there's so many lessons from history. I'm going to keep banging this drum. There's so many lessons from history that are predictive and illustrative of what it looks like going forward. And what it looks like going forward is that this is a long process, is like what we've learned from every single thing. There's not going to be some immediate cure. There's going to be a lot of ups and downs in this process. And so I encourage people to try to embrace the uncertainty. That's easy for me to say, but the uncertainty is, like, if you can have a healthy relationship with not knowing right now, that is actually going to be, I think, one of the most important things you can do for your own well-being. And it may help guide certain decisions going forward. Sorry, I'm not super upbeat this week because I'm trying to, like, tamp down people's expectation that antibody tests are some way out of this, or that they're going to work really well. We're just not there yet.
All right. Well, where we are is, I think, the end of the podcast, because we are out of time. We're going to skip the...
You guys can keep talking. I'll just jump off.
No, I got a hard out as well. Want to do a quick VR minute? Let's do literally a minute of VR. Here we go. Here's the interstitial.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
We've already used 12 seconds of the VR Minute just playing that music. I'm sorry, Jeremy. Okay, quickly, Oculus Connect is canceled essentially this year. Facebook is not doing any events for through June 2021 of more than 50 people. So Oculus Connect will be a virtual conference. Seems like a right place to launch Horizons ahead of that to do announcements. And they have Oculus venues on the Quest, and they are in a right position.
I hadn't considered that. Like, that would be interesting if they used Horizons to host something for the event. I like it, Norm. Yeah.
Right? Right? They already had demos of it a year ago. Mm-hmm. And presumably...
It's in alpha. Like, there have been people who have leaked the alpha invites. Like, it's being tested right now. I like that idea.
Scale it up and let's have... I mean, HTC has done... They did for their Vive thing, a virtual conference, and there are lots of platforms where you can get people with avatars. You know, it's not VR chat exactly, but, you know, with tools to do presentations and have conversations. And it seems like, you know, making this announcement now and it being a good 5-6 months away from when they would be hosting it, there'll be time to develop a platform, you know, and get headsets out there for people. I mean, if you're going to be going to an Oculus Connect, you probably have a headset. So it's a perfect audience. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that, if it's something to look forward to.
I'm looking forward to seeing how they transform the event anyway. I mean, it's sad that we're not going to be able to go. I really look forward to this event. They do a great job with it every year. But I, you know, at the same point, I look forward to it so much because it's so well done. And I imagine they'll apply the same level of quality to their virtual event. So VR or not, I'm excited to see how it translates.
Yep.
There's a new Oculus Quest software update, 16.0. Two notable things is that if you are left-handed, you can switch functionality between right and left-handed buttons. And also, if you are someone who doesn't want to use a controller and just wants to use the hand tracking, you can actually set up the Guardian now. And so they're inching toward a world where having actual controllers is almost optional for a VR headset.
You can also use your pass-through as your home environment, which, you know, I guess that keeps you more in touch with your home. But people have been equating that to this sort of step into augmented reality, because you can bring up the web browsers and apply them to your room. And basically, I've done that by stepping outside of my boundaries, and which brings up pass-through. And it's pretty neat. It's sort of a taste of what you could do. It is Facebook AR VR. Like, it is that they are working on an AR, you know, path as well as VR. So, like, you could see where this potentially could go.
But the pass-through is still black and white. It's still 30 FPS. You know, it's scaled up and there's reprojection for geometry. But you have all the issues of combination convergence of where the sweet spot is.
There's no slam. It's very, it's 1950s television.
It's comfort, right? It's a static black and white.
Yeah.
Upload VR had a story about a leak in the software, the firmware, alluding to new touch controllers that have better finger sensing, haptics, and tracking, codename Jedi, and more precise tracking seems to be something that is the most apparent here. And it gave us some more to think about, because apparently right now the controllers track at only 30 FPS.
I didn't know this. I guess Carmack tweeted, you know, a response to somebody. And what's interesting is that the cameras on the Quest actually run at 60, but they use like even frames for world mapping and standard light, and then odd frames for controller tracking.
For the IR blinking.
And they lower the contrast, they lower the exposure way down so that it just sees the IR LEDs on the controllers, which gives them, you know, they can more easily isolate them.
I mean, the fact that the software and these camera sensors can switch between high normal exposure and low exposure on an every other frame basis.
That's crazy.
It's impressive, right?
Yeah.
And it speaks to the type of, you know, cameras and lenses they're using. But this new firmware and Jedi driver that's referenced in this firmware talks about a 60 hertz IR LED, which gives some credence to the idea that maybe a future version of the Quest may not only have better tracked IR controllers, so less of it for prediction, less prediction, less software required, but maybe even better frame rate tracking for the outside world as well, if they're still doing the on-off every other frame.
It's interesting because I don't feel like that's a major problem. I feel like when the controllers are within view, I get as much tracking as I've ever wanted. It's when they go outside of view that's the issue. And that's where I think the new IMU might come into play, because there's also a massively better IMU on the device, which is, like, you know, 5 years more current than the old one. And it's got like 1/6 the noise, and it runs at almost, like, I don't know, a fraction of the power. It's better in every respect, and it should provide more accurate IMU. And I wonder if they'll be able to rely on that more than they can currently, because most games, they give you a second or two of tracking when you go outside of the field of view of the cameras, but it stops after that. I wonder if this better IMU might actually enhance that, because that would be phenomenal.
Yeah, the other thing that's alluded to is better analog finger sensing. And the question is whether this is going to be, again, with the kind of capacitance sensors on the physical controllers, or maybe a combination of the physical sensors as well as the computer vision on the hand tracking. Maybe combining that will get you the ability to use your hand controllers for holding something physical, but also be able to see where your thumb and index fingers are, or maybe even your other fingers are relative to the controllers.
Yeah, it's an analog thing. It's interesting. I wonder what that's going to mean. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Do you think this is a new controller they're going to release, or is this a whole new headset plus controller? Like, is this just going to be an upgrade for existing Quest users? You can buy the new controller, or is this paired with a new headset?
I think from an R&D perspective, you got to go, you can't, it makes much less sense to spend R&D on one half of the equation to make up for the inadequacies of the other half than to develop both at once, with the added benefit of then also being able to release a SKU that doesn't have any controllers, right? You start with the headset first. The headset's the thing that they want to improve over time. Controllers get a natural benefit of, you know, if they're gonna really go all in with hand tracking and, you know, hand gestures, then make that work really well, and then make the controllers also work well because of those added benefits.
Why would the driver be in the current Quest releases? That's crazy. Like, it makes it feel like it's a imminent release, you know, like imminent being this year, which is like impossible, right?
No idea. There's a really cool hand tracking video done by someone working in VR. You guys seen this? This is like the hand being separated from the virtual hand being separated from the real hand, but you're still using hand tracking to basically have like the thing in Adam's Family.
Yeah, I like it. I wonder how that feels.
That's the number one thing I can understand, like looking at the video, what's supposed to happen, but it's exactly what VR is great for, because I can't understand what it actually feels like, that disconnect between the visual and and the physical. The company Spaces, they're an LBE company. I think they work with Century Theaters to have location-based kind of the void style experiences. Obviously, those LBEs are struggling right now, but that dev team has worked on now at home a plugin for video chat, where they created basically a Unity environment where you can be in an avatar with like a whiteboard in Unity, and then have a virtual camera, and then you capture that in something like a Zoom call or a Skype call, so that you can have meetings where, you know, maybe half the people are just webcammed, not in VR, but in VR, you could actually tethered VR. You could actually be giving demonstrations and manipulating objects and showing ideas.
And the person in VR can see the Zoom call?
They would just have a window, a floating window.
Wow.
It gets piped back in with the Zoom calls. You can download it right now. It's just at Spaces, I believe, spaces.com. I think that's the name of the... Yep, spaces.com. You can just sign up and they'll send you a download and you can try it out.
All right.
Tribeca Film Festival is now... they had a VR selection of short films. This is VR video, immersive video, 360 video, and it's now all uploaded to Oculus Media. So I'll put in the show notes a link to a Facebook thread where you can just click save to headset and then watch it on a Quest or a Go.
And before you ask, the show notes is the YouTube description or the description on tested.com?
It's the YouTube description is where the links will be.
The YouTube description.
YouTube there you description. Go. Yes. Go to the YouTube description. And then I think that's it. Yeah.
All right.
I want to plug a couple things real quick. So last night when you're listening to this, I started streaming on Twitch. I'm going to try to do some fundraisers for the Alamo Draft House by watching movies and then dissecting the science in them. We're going to try to do it every Wednesday. And then the second plug is... join the Tested Discord. This is only a test channel. You can get in there and ask us questions and suggest topics for us to consider for every week. So please get in there and ask questions.
Yep. We'll hopefully have time to take questions next week. And we do have an outro song this week. We asked for them in weeks past. If you want to create your own outro piece, just search raw outro song file or the Zonely Test outro, and it'll take us to the forums. You can download the SoundCloud file and post it there. But this one comes from Black Powder Engine, and I have not listened to it before, but here goes. Thank you for listening this week. Thank you guys, Jeremy, Kishore, for joining. It's good to see your faces, and we will see you next time.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
The silhouette of the ship looking top down orthogonally.
So Jeremy,
yes,
your role is commander.
Jeremy's already in the holodeck right now.
Don't we also need a phaser?
Execute.
I think it's going to be a thing.
Here we go. Let's do this. Engage.
Jeremy's out of the game.
Sucker.
Oh my god.
I can't believe that we pulled that off.
That was frenetic. Oh my god. Live long and prosper. We'll be right back.
Well done. Thank you so much. That was awesome. Good memories, good times. We'll see you next week. Bye.